some of the time, and rather than influence just opinion, it wants people to take a particular course of action. The company based its PSYOPs strategies on propaganda techniques developed by a virtual lab called the Behavioral Dynamics Institute, run out of Leeds University by Professor Phil Taylor, a consultant to UK and American defense agencies until his death at 56 in 2010. The article identified SCL only as funded by private investors. Company chief Nigel Oakes described its nefarious skullduggery as mind-bending for political purposes. In a March 20, 2018 interview with Yahoo Finance, Oakes described himself as a man without much of an ethical radar. According to SCL's public affairs director, Mark Broughton, basically we're launching ourselves on the defense market and homeland security market at the same time. Aware that the company might face criticism over its promotion of totalitarian security states, Broughton emphasized to Slate the company's role in saving lives. There is some altruism in it, he said grudgingly, but we also want to earn money. How war games became instruments for imposing obedience. Dark Winter, Atlantic Storm, and Global Mercury were only three of over a dozen germ games staged by military, medical, and intelligence planners leading up to COVID-19. Each of these Kafka-esque exercises became uncanny predictors of a dystopian age that pandemic planners dubbed the new normal. The consistent feature is an affinity among their simulation designers for militarizing medicine and introducing centralized autocratic governance. Each rehearsal ends with the same grim punchline. The global pandemic is an excuse to justify the imposition of tyranny and coerced vaccination. The repetition of these exercises suggests that they serve as a kind of rehearsal or training drill for an underlying agenda to coordinate the global dismantlement of democratic governance. Military intelligence analysts first introduced scenario planning as a strategic device during World War II. RAND's iconic military planner, Herman Kahn, used sophisticated war game simulations to model nuclear engagement strategies in the Cold War era. Working for Royal Dutch Shell, futurologists Pierre Wack and Peter Schwartz of the Global Business Network, GBN, pioneered scenario planning simulations as a strategic device for their corporate clients in the 1970s and 1980s. By the millennium, simulations had evolved into an indispensable vehicle for military policymakers, intelligence agency planners, public health technocrats, and the petroleum and pharmaceutical multinationals for reinforcing prescribed responses that allow predictable and rigid control of the outcomes of future crises. After 9/11, the rising biosecurity cartel adopted simulations as signaling mechanisms for choreographing lockstep response among corporate, political, and military technocrats charged with managing global exigencies. Scenario planning became an indispensable device for multiple power centers to coordinate complex strategies for simultaneously imposing coercive controls upon democratic societies across the globe. Virtually all of the scenario planning for pandemics employ technical assumptions and strategies familiar to anyone who has read the CIA's notorious psychological warfare manuals for shattering indigenous societies, obliterating traditional economics and social bonds, for using imposed isolation and the demolition of traditional economies to crush resistance, to foster chaos, demoralization, dependence, and fear, and for imposing centralized and autocratic governance. In particular, the exercises incorporate PSYOP techniques gleaned from the notorious Milgram obedience experiments. In those 1960s exercises, Yale social psychology professor Dr. Stanley Milgram was able to show that researchers could formulaically manipulate ordinary citizens from all walks of life to violate their own conscience and commit atrocities, so long as an authority figure, a doctor in a white lab coat, ordered them to do so. The subjects believed they were torturing fellow volunteers by electrocution, out of sight in an adjacent room. As the doctor instructed them to rev up the juice, the recruits could hear the nightmarish screaming of actors pretending to be suffering electrocution and their pleadings for mercy. Of Milgram's 40 subjects, some 65% administered the full-bore 450-volt shocks they had been told were potentially fatal. Milgram described his experiments as proof that obedience to authority trumps morality and conscience. Stark authority was pitted against the subject's strongest moral imperatives against hurting others, and with the subject's ears ringing with the screams of the victims, authority won more often than not. The extreme willingness of adults to go to almost any lengths on the command of an authority constitutes the chief finding of the study. In his book, A Question of Torture, CIA Interrogation from the Cold War to the War on Terror, University of Wisconsin historian Alfred W. McCoy suggests that the Yale obedience experiments were funded by the CIA as part of MKUltra's studies on the control of human behavior. During that time, the CIA funneled money through various federal agencies to fund 185 independent researchers to perform sinister behavioral manipulation studies at universities across North America. Milgram first proposed his obedience research in a 1960 solicitation to the Group Psychology Branch of the Office of Naval Research, ONR, a key conduit for the CIA's MKUltra mind control experiments. The dean who hired Milgram later as a professor at City University of New York was a former deputy director of ONR. Milgram's Yale mentor was Irving L. Janis, who wrote the seminal Air Force study of Soviet mind control and hypnosis for the RAND Corporation. Milgram's other connections to the CIA's psychological warfare program are too numerous to mention here. In an equally important revelation, the CIA mind control experiments identified social isolation as the primary protocol for controlling societal and individual behavior. In 1960, one of the agency's most active contractors, Lawrence Hinkle of Cornell, confirmed the significance of social isolation for the CIA mind control effort in light of the neurological literature, the most promising of all known techniques. The CIA's research found that the effect of isolation on the brain function on an individual is much like that which occurs if he is beaten, starved, or deprived of sleep. Social isolation affects organic brain development and the human body, length of life, cardiovascular health, and so on. Social isolation doubles the risk of death in blacks while increasing the risk of early death in Caucasians by 60-84%, while other studies show that it is safer to smoke 15 cigarettes a day or be an alcoholic than to be socially isolated. Meta-analysis co-authored by Julianne Holt-Lundstad, Ph.D., a professor of psychology and neuroscience at Brigham Young University, found that lack of social connection heightens health risks as much as smoking 15 cigarettes a day or having alcohol use disorder. Holt-Lundstad also found that social isolation is twice as harmful to physical and mental health as obesity. There is robust evidence that social isolation significantly increases risk for premature mortality, and the magnitude of the risk exceeds that of many leading health indicators. NIH's collaboration with the CIA in these odious torture, obedience, and brainwashing experiments heaps additional ignominy on the agency. During the 1950s, NIH scientist Dr. Maitland Baldwin conducted social isolation experiments on monkeys and humans at NIH headquarters and CIA safe houses. MKUltra's experiments used expendables, people whose deaths or disappearances would go unnoticed, including a rather gruesome experiment in which Baldwin had subjected a soldier to 40 hours of isolation, causing him to go insane and to kick apart the box in which Maitland imprisoned him. Maitland, who told his Operation Artichoke case officer that isolating subjects for over 40 hours could cause irreparable damage and perhaps be terminal, nevertheless agreed to go forward if the agency could provide cover and subjects. The various scenario planning simulations provided a unique forum to convene key decision makers and to introduce and then to sanction with authoritative voices previously unspeakable conduct that violated democratic and ethical norms. That conduct included the forced isolation and quarantine of entire populations, including the healthy, censoring free speech, violating privacy with track and trace surveillance systems, trampling property rights and religious freedoms, and obliterating traditional economies via nationwide business lockdowns, enforced masking, coercive medical interventions, and other assaults on human rights, civil rights, constitutions, and democracies. With each new simulation, the staccato repetition of the message by trusted experts, doctors in lab coats, and authoritative collectives like Secretary of State Madeleine Albright, Senator Sam Nunn, WHO Director General Gro Harlem Brundtland, and Senator Tom Daschle, reinforced the lesson that censorship, isolation, the militarization of medicine, totalitarian controls, and coercive vaccine mandates are the only appropriate response to pandemics. Scenario planning, in other words, is a potent brainwashing technique for creating and fortifying anti-democratic orthodoxies among key political leaders, the press, and the technocracy, and preparing the nation to tolerate a coup d'etat against its constitution without resistance. Lockstep Simulation 2010. In 2009, President Obama declared biosecurity as the spear tip of U.S. foreign policy, dispersing memos to all government agencies instructing them to integrate biosecurity into their mission. By 2010, U.S. spy agencies were demonstrating a growing interest in vaccines as a foreign policy instrument. Just as the Cold War and later on the War on Terror had rationalized U.S. military presence across the world as a bulwark against brushfire nationalist rebellions purportedly orchestrated by a communist monolith, vaccination programs could justify interventions in developing countries with high disease burdens as a tool for social and political control. In 2010, the WHO pronounced biosecurity as the centerpiece of its approach for managing global risks. That same month, as Bill Gates delivered his Decade of Vaccines speech at the UN, biosecurity, the war on microbes, was already eclipsing the war on Islamic terrorism as the preferred driver of the security state cartel. A few days later, Pierre Schwartz authored a scenario report funded by the Rockefeller Foundation titled Scenarios for the Future of Technology and International Development. A section called Lockstep reinforced the burgeoning orthodoxy that rigid global tyranny was the antidote to infectious disease. It reads, "In 2012, the pandemic that the world had been anticipating for years finally hit. Unlike 2009's H1N1, this new influenza strain, originating from wild geese, was extremely virulent and deadly. Even the most pandemic-prepared nations were quickly overwhelmed when the virus streaked around the world, infecting nearly 20% of the global population and killing 8 million in just 7 months. The pandemic also had a deadly effect on economies. International mobility of both people and goods screeched to a halt, debilitating industries like tourism and breaking global supply chains. Even locally, normally bustling shops and office buildings sat empty for months, devoid of both employees and customers. During the pandemic, national leaders around the world flexed their authority and imposed airtight rules and restrictions, from the mandatory wearing of face masks to body temperature checks at the entries to communal spaces like train stations and supermarkets. Even after the pandemic faded, this more authoritarian control and oversight of citizens and their activities stuck and even intensified. In order to protect themselves from the spread of increasingly global problems, from pandemics and transnational terrorism to environmental crises and rising poverty, leaders around the world took a firmer grip on power. Schwartz's chilling document goes on to predict that citizens terrified by germs and orchestrated propaganda willingly relinquish their civil and constitutional rights. The population, Schwartz predicts, will not start rebelling against the new tyranny and authoritarian clampdowns for more than 10 years. Intelligence agencies left their fingerprints all over these scenario planning exercises. Schwartz, like O'Toole, Larson, Cadlick, Woolsey, and David, is one of the many leading promoters of weaponized vaccines as a foreign policy tool with deep connections to the intelligence apparatus. Schwartz's resume chronicles multiple touchpoints with spy agencies before and after he authored the lockstep scenario. In 1972, Schwartz joined the Stanford Research Institute, later SRI International, an early pioneer in computer technology and artificial intelligence. Schwartz rose to run SRI's Strategic Environment Center at a time when SRI was hosting the CIA's notorious MKUltra program and actively researching psychological warfare, including the sophisticated use of propaganda, torture, and psychiatric chemicals to shatter societies and impose centralized control. Schwartz left to become head of scenario planning for Royal Dutch Shell. He then co-founded the Global Business Network, GBN, in 1987 as a corporate consultant specializing in analyzing intelligence and in future think strategies. Shell Oil was GBN's highest revenue client. In the early 1990s, Ken McCarthy, who would become an early pioneer of practical efforts to commercialize the Internet, met Schwartz at a large Thanksgiving gathering in a remote location in rural Harris, California. Schwartz introduced himself to McCarthy, an anthropology graduate from Princeton, and Schwartz began probing McCarthy's interest in being recruited for a contract with an unnamed West African country that involved weakening tribal and family structures on behalf of a federal government. Recalling the encounter, McCarthy told me, "I found Schwartz's proposal intensely disturbing." Schwartz dismissed McCarthy's qualms as naive. McCarthy says, "It made a lasting impression on me, so much so that I've recounted the story many times over the years." Schwartz's client, Shell Oil, had extensive oil holdings in the Ogoni region of Nigeria. In 1995, the Nigerian government executed Ogoni environmental leader, writer, and television producer Ken Sarowiwa and eight other environmental organizers based on charges that they had incited violence. Sarowiwa's arrest, trial by a military tribunal, and subsequent execution followed a harassment campaign against him and other Ogoni environmental leaders, which started in 1993. After they repeatedly mobilized peaceful demonstrations against Shell, attracting over 300,000 of the region's total population of 600,000. The United Nations General Assembly and the European Union condemned Sarowiwa's execution, and the United States recalled its ambassador to Nigeria. In 1993, Schwartz, along with Stuart Brand and Nicholas Negroponte, was one of the driving forces behind the founding of Wired magazine, which became the central clearinghouse for mainstream news coverage of the burgeoning online ecosystem. Wired quickly earned notoriety as a clearinghouse for intelligence agency chatter. Prior to Wired, Mondo 2000, the Bay Area's original tech and culture magazine, reflected the progressive, idealistic viewpoints of many of the pioneer tech innovators. In contrast, Wired, which appropriated Mondo 2000's look and feel and no small number of its employees, glorified military and intelligence agency celebrities and corporate CEOs who happened to be clients of Nicholas Negroponte's MIT lab. Wired gained snowballing prominence in the early 2000s at the same time that the CIA launched its notorious investment firm InQtel to infiltrate the tech industry and put Silicon Valley on steroids with easy terms and government contracts. Scenario planner Tara O'Toole served as InQtel's executive vice president. It's worth recalling here that the defense and intelligence agencies had a beachhead in the tech industry from its birth. The Defense Advanced Research Project Agency, DARPA, created the Internet by building the ARPANET grid in 1969. DARPA is the